Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Greetings. Thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Lady P of Pville. No relation to Master P. I don't know where he's from. And joining me today with her mole placed just so, Lady Kristen Sales.
Thank you for having me, Lady P.
All right. And making his FlixWise debut is a film critic with an extremely convincing British accent. Please welcome to the show, Michael Leader. Hi, Michael.
Oh, thank you, Lady P. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. And can you just quickly tell listeners a little bit about yourself and which publications you've written for?
Okay, well, my day job is I do all the online business for Film 4, which is a film channel and production company over here. But then when the sun goes down, I'm a freelance critic. I've written for Sight and Sound and Little White Lies in the past. And also in the last year or so, I've started programming and distributing films with a film label called Misc Films.
All right, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later on in the show. But listeners, we have an honest-to-goodness writer for Sight and Sound. And that should come in handy, because today we have yet another entry on the Sight and Sound Critics poll. This time it's number 59, Stanley Kubrick's 1975 feature, Barry Lyndon. We've already had one Kubrick offering, the sixth greatest film of all time, 2001 A Space Odyssey. But listen up to find out how Lyndon stacks up. Then we're going to talk about an exciting new project that Michael's been working on, involving a new distribution company, as he just mentioned, and it screens little seen or hard to find films that deserve greater attention. And then finally, we'll close things out with some final notes of positivity. All right, you guys set?
Yep.
10 paces away? All right, let's fire away. First up, we have today's Sight and Sound entry, number 59. Stanley Kubrick's Barry Lyndon, adapted from an 1844 novel by William Makepeace Thackeray, ironically titled The Luck of Barry Lyndon. The film steps us through the early life, middle age, and eventual death of a poor Irishman named Redmond Barry, who's played by Mr. Ryan O'Neill. Mr. Barry of Barryville starts off penniless and ends up with less. But between these periods of destitution, we see Barry riding high on the tides of Providence. The tale is told episodically, with each chapter ending with either an ebb or flow in Barry's fortunes. His life's greatest triumphs, falling in love, winning his first duel, getting his first job, his first marriage, the birth of his son, are all eventually undone by a combination of hubris and the pitiless hand of fate. But no matter, Redmond Barry, or Barry Lyndon as he would eventually be known, is but a man, and like all men, his only job is to scurry about the earth for a bit and then die. And in that venture, he was, for a time, a modest success. Of course, I can't very well talk about this film without mentioning the lengthy production, which lasted nearly a year. The extended shooting time was the result of a number of factors, all of which have to do with Stanley Kubrick's exacting directorial style. He famously insisted on not using electricity to light the shots, which meant he and cinematographer John Alcott had to light interiors using either available light or candlelight. The effect is striking, as every shot looks like it was stolen out of London's Victoria and Albert Museum. Then there's also Kubrick's insistence on doing somewhere between 30 to 50 takes per setup. There's no question that Kubrick was a perfectionist, but do all these thousands of takes, when strung together, equal a masterpiece? We shall discuss. All right. All right, I'll start with you, Michael.
Mm-hmm.
Do you like Barry Lyndon?
I like it a great deal, yeah.
Okay, cool, yeah.
Thank God.
Yeah, I mean, you've come to the right place. I think you'll find you're in good company.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, yeah. So when did you first see it? What's your relationship to the film?
So I first saw it as a teenager when I was ticking off probably the Sight and Sound list as a wannabe cinephile. So I got the DVD and spent an afternoon one summer holiday and was completely blown away. When I went to university, I studied English literature. So the fact that this book feels like a doorstop novel really, really appealed to me. I don't want to think of the decades since I went to university, but in the years since, I've revisited it on a number of occasions. And every time I go back to it, I'm just impressed by its formal beauty and its cool narrative style. and all of the fine details that make it into, I think, probably top three Kubrick films for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, here.
Sales, how about you?
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
I first saw it just a couple months ago. This was like the Kubrick that I hadn't seen.
Mm-hmm.
Because living in Los Angeles, I knew that it would play eventually. Not on a 70, unfortunately, but in a 35. And we saw it together.
We did.
At the New Beverly, which is a great cinema here in LA. So I was waiting to see it, you know, in the right way. And then I watched it again on a, we'll say DVD.
Yeah.
Sure. a less sterling quality. But, you know, it was wonderful. Yeah. And as someone who didn't grow up with this and didn't have a certain, I've never been a Kubrick person, per se. I've sort of picked up his films here and there. I've never done a proper filmography for him. And so I kind of like because the discourse around him is so serious and entrenched and kind of fervent. I like to be more of a laid-back observer and to sort of take his filmography a little more casually. And I like thinking about Barry Lyndon in those terms, sort of outside of the cult of Kubrick, and it allows me to sort of experience it just as a film experience rather than as a lineage to a great director.
Yeah. I think, and this film more than any of the others, or at least in my experience, like it does allow for you to just take it on its own terms as opposed to the rest of the, perhaps this isn't true of his Hollywood films, but certainly, you know, there's a certain cult around Clockwork Orange and 2001 and Doctor Strangelove, mm-hmm. The Shining, that I don't think has amassed for this one.
No,
though it certainly has its fans.
This is the dark horse.
Yeah.
It's like it's the art house pick.
Yeah.
Although I'm not sure if it's the same in the States, but certainly in the critical community over here, there are those ardent admirers of Barry Lyndon and Eyes Wide Shut, which I think are the two lesser seen or lesser praised widely of Kubrick's movies. So
absolutely.
If you're that sort of person who's tempted by film Twitter conversation, Barry Lyndon needs to be seen.
Yes.
Yeah, but I think the discourse around like a critical darling versus the kind of films that have infiltrated pop culture, I guess in America to the extent, have the kind of movies that people are like, oh, if you're into movies, you need to see this, which is like what Clockwork Orange has become mm-hmm. for a young man, especially, or even these other Kubrick films. And this one has not penetrated to that level, which I think gives it a certain rarefied air. And I think it also makes it very ripe for a certain kind of critic to say, like, actually, this one's the best because it's the least adopted. It's the least, this is the least popular,
yeah.
I feel like. And it's a little more intellectual. It's not as visceral as something like Clockwork Orange or Full Metal Jacket, or it doesn't have that kind of the violence.
Mm-hmm.
I think this will be something that will be so interesting in our discussion is that, you know, Kubrick is a transatlantic filmmaker. He lived and worked in the UK for, you know, most of his peak. And this is probably the least accessible film for an American audience.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll be fascinated to see what you two take from this film that maybe
certainly.
I'm taking for granted coming up in the definitely the British culture.
Right.
I mean, it's so entrenched in European history and in a British literary tradition, neither of which are particularly studied topics,
yeah.
I think, among American cinephiles of a certain kind.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about why this film maybe is a little bit more, maybe it's a little less immediate than some of his more popular films, and a lot of that is due to the structure. So let's talk about how the story is told and how Kubrick kind of creates this distancing effect. And I think that's in large part because of the narration, which in the novel it's narrated by the Lyndon character, the Barry Lyndon character. But in the film, Kubrick opted to use an omniscient narrator. So I think that adds to the kind of the austerity, I guess. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's the I mean, it's certainly a source of a lot of the humor of the film. And maybe that's a kind of humor that may not translate or doesn't immediately register as humor. It's like it's steeped in irony. But yeah, what do you guys make of it?
There's an interview that Kubrick gave with Michel Simon, the French critic, and he says that the reason why he changed the narration from first person to an omniscient narrator is he thinks that he sees film as the truly objective art form. Once you put everything in front of a camera, the audience will see everything, so you can't have a roguish, unreliable narrator as with the novel, because the audience will see that Lyndon is lying or fabricating the truth. So instead he adopts this very dry and droll, impartial, omniscient narrator. And it is the source of such humour, especially in the first half of the film. Very dry, ironic, and quite cold and cruel at times.
Yes.
But it's certainly there, and it's what I think goes against some of the negative perceptions of the film as being, serious. It's certainly a funny film, although Kubrick would hate it to have seen it called a comedy.
Right.
It's certainly more of an art piece.
Yeah. It's so clearly funny, though. It's like, I think it's the film of his that makes me laugh the most, except aside from maybe Dr. Strangelove, but it's similarly absurd.
I agree. Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, I think to the omniscient narration sort of takes away from a driving central energy. So the central character is not a protagonist in the way that I think American audiences like to see a protagonist. It's not a passive protagonist per se, but he is at the mercy of a higher structure. I don't want to say a higher power, but there are things going on he is not in control of his own narrative, which I think makes it sort of almost anti-American in a certain way, because that's not the way that we construct our stories or our protagonists. And so I think it brings an element of almost fatalism, but also kind of just an understanding that Barry and we at large are at the whims of structures that exist before we come on the scene and exist after the scene. And I'm thinking of the final title card, which is just like, all of these things happened in the 18th century, and anyway, it doesn't matter, they're all dead now. Yeah. which to me is hilarious, but also kind of poignant, because it's true.
Mm-hmm.
All of this, and let's talk about the length too, all of this 3.5 hours of a movie, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. thousands or hundreds of thousands or maybe even millions of people died in the Seven Years' War. Who cares?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Life is as silly or as important or as wrenching as we make it in the moment, and then it's gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's certainly an example of the sort of narrative that a lot of English literature at the time was dealing with, this idea of a man proceeding through society, and through that journey we see elements of social satire and the class structure and history and so on. But Barry Lyndon, especially in the film, is a peculiarly naive, and I don't want to say passive, because I think he is quite active in some ways, but he's certainly a character who things happen to, rather than a character who really takes control of situations. And the look of Barry Lyndon, you know, as a title, is a great title for that, because he is somebody who is in finding his fortune, he is completely beholden to good or bad fortune. The luck of others running out or his luck running up. It is what defines the narrative.
Mm-hmm. And you're right that he's not fully passive, which is something that I realized the second time I watched it, which is in the first half, he takes many very proactive makes many proactive decisions, principally for his honor or physical feats, the duels, the battles, the saving his commander when he's in the Prussian army. These are all kind of acts of bravery in a way, and yet they sort of amass to nothing, mm-hmm. kind of. You know, he does them, which you could say is a very proactive, but that he is not rewarded for that because there is no cumulative effect of bravery that will lead to a reward, because it's not that kind of movie. I think the passivity that people pick up on is just Ryan O'Neill's performance.
Mm-hmm.
His bearing and his face. Like, I think, like, Ryan O'Neill is a handsome guy, right? But he has that kind of cow-like handsomeness, like that kind of, he has like a broad face.
Yeah.
Like a big, blank, open face. And he's just kind of, benign, in his looks. And so it's not like there's not a lot of active attractiveness or sexiness. Like, that's not the performance. So what comes across is just kind of like this blank, open canvas that things happen to, and he's really reacting to them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like it's not a comedic performance necessarily, but I think of like Buster Keaton's kind of open face. He reacts to the things around him, or he is sort of batted about by forces within the narrative. And I feel like that is kind of what Ryan O'Neill sort of accomplishes, mm-hmm. in this film. It's just to sort of be like the pinball, you know, that is sort of, you know, taken here or there depending on what happens.
Right.
And you're right to say Buster Keaton in a way, because so much of so many sequences of the film are essentially silent. Long drawn out scenes where it is just exchanged glances across a table. So when he first seduces Lady Lyndon, or the duel scenes, it is just this blank canvas of a face. And then, of course, Kubrick's mastery around the actors, around the props, yeah, of the actors, exactly. in the scene that make it work.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, when I first saw the film, I thought Ryan O'Neill plays the perfect dope, just like the perfect buffoonish idiot. Mm-hmm. But watching it the second time, I realize it's not Barry Lyndon that's the dope necessarily. It's everyone, anyone. The film is condescending to him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not that he is impassive. He takes many steps. He leaves the army. He joins the army. He leaves the army. He challenges other men.
Yeah, he fights for the woman he loves.
Exactly.
Like, he's trying to do something. But I feel like you're right that the people around him are like, don't do this, or you're screwing it up for everybody.
Right.
And he is very, like, stubborn in the first half.
But we, the audience, know that this is foolish, mm-hmm. because the narrator is telling us so.
That's true, but I also think it's kind of endearing. I think that's the push and pull between what Barry Lyndon does or doesn't do versus the other people in the narrative who react to him versus the narrator.
Mm-hmm.
So we know from the beginning that it's not going to end well for Barry because the narrator tells us. But I still feel like he's kind of, as a character, I'm kind of rooting for him. I wouldn't say that my feelings are entirely positive, but there is something, I don't know, there is something endearing about Barry Lyndon. I don't feel like he's necessarily a dope. I just feel like he is trying, he has a certain purity to him, and he's trying to navigate. I feel for someone who doesn't have the social skills to navigate different strata of society, and yet he tries to keep going, and he goes from a very pastoral life to a life of gambling halls and sort of luxury and continental wealth, and he doesn't know how to do either of those. Mm-hmm. So the spheres in which he finds himself, he's constantly trying to adapt. He just doesn't know how, mm-hmm. but he tries. And that's that's an endearing quality, I think.
Sure. Michael, how do you feel about Barry Lyndon? What is your experience watching the film? Are you rooting for him as you watch? Or are you rooting for him to fail or succeed or both?
Well, I think it's a very inherently complicated relationship with the character. As we've said, you know, already, this sense of whether he's passive or active, whether he is naive or whether he is conniving. I think that's one of the strengths of the film, is that you're constantly reassessing your relationship. It's not a film that's interested in interiority or conventional character arcs or character relationships. However, on a scene-to-scene level, we do relate to him differently. I think it is a little stymied by the fact that Ryan O'Neill, in his legacy, will never come back from the viral YouTube sensation of his line reading from Tough Guys Don't Dance, the "Oh Man, Oh God, Oh Man, Oh God" that got him the Razzie Award for Worst Actor. That's Tough Men Don't Dance, which is the sold editorial credit of Norman Mailer in the late 80s. If you've not seen that clip, maybe save yourself, save your vision of Ryan O'Neill by not watching it.
Yeah, if you ever want to watch another Ryan O'Neill movie, yeah.
Yeah, but in terms of Barry Lyndon, as you say, he does have positive qualities. He fights for the woman he loves. He clearly loves his son. And there is that very emotional scene where Brian is dying, and he asks his father to retell the completely fabricated story of his war efforts. However, on the flip side, there is the scene where he finally marries Lady Lyndon, and they're in the carriage, and he's smoking a pipe, and she's saying, "You know, darling, please, can you not smoke?" And he just blows a full lung of smoke right in her face, which is. I mean, on a performance level, that's one of the great dick moves in cinema, in my estimations. But I think because of Kubrick's lack of interest in characters in this particular film, but then also you can kind of see that across his filmography in general. Many of his characters do not have the interiority of that you'd expect from more mainstream Hollywood films in particular. It is hard to figure out whether you are rooting for him or not. It's not a hero's journey, and it's not a fully anti-hero's journey. And Thackeray, when writing the novel, described his novel, you know, The Look of Barry Lyndon, as, you know, the first novel without a hero. So personally, I think that's what's interesting. Wherever I go back to it, I reassess my relationship with that character. And sometimes it is whether you believe that Ryan O'Neill is giving good performance or not, and sometimes it's whether you're not sure whether the either narrator or the director wants you to like him or not. It's an inherently complicated relationship.
Right, yeah, and it's not unlike a lot of Kubrick's films where you're often not sure how you feel about the protagonist.
And I think that feeds into the casting in general. Like, how many of Kubrick's films do you remember the protagonist in? I mean, apart from, say, The Shining.
Right.
Or, you know, sometimes he casts, you know, popular famous actors in those roles. Sometimes he don't. Do people really remember Hal from 2001, or they remember the actual human characters from 2001? Mm-hmm. So that's where people sometimes accuse Kubrick of being almost, you know, inhumane as a director, not interested in the ways that humans relate to each other. However, I think Barry Lyndon, the ace it has in its deck, is that all of the supporting characters are incredibly fascinating and played brilliantly by all of these character actors. Who I'm not sure. I wonder if either of you recognize any of those people, because some of them are definitely from a British stage or television or film tradition.
Yeah.
Well, we were just talking about this because the actor who plays the priest, Lady Lyndon's sort of right-hand man, I knew that I knew him and his face, and I couldn't remember where it was from, but he's in The Devils.
Yeah, he's in The Devils, yeah.
Yeah, he plays a very similar sort of sadistic clergyman in The Devils, and that guy just has, I'm blanking on the actor's name, but he's a Ken Russell stock man, and so just his physiognomy is so immediately I don't want to say unsettling, that's kind of rude, but so unique that as soon as he shows up in the frame, it's like, whoa, there's something.
There's a human that looks like that?
There's something going on there. I mean, and obviously it's exaggerated as well, but I mean, and then I think that guy, that performance immediately, and then I don't know. Do you want to talk about?
I mean, I have to talk about Marissa Berenson, right?
Marissa Berenson. Oh, yeah.
I'm on record as loving Cabaret, top three favorite movies of all time. So to me, this is the other Marissa Berenson movie. but that said, it's like if there are two great movies, if you're only going to make two great movies in your career, I mean, you could do worse than Cabaret and Barry Lyndon. But she's also fantastic in this movie. And all these performances, we talk about, you know, active versus passive characters, but certainly the acting, due to the lighting setup, they have to be, at the very least, very slow moving, which may add to the sense of the passivity. But she's hardly allowed to move, and yet her face conveys so much. My heart breaks for her and her character, which I think is part of why while the Barry Lyndon may not have a conventional character arc, those sort of very telling moments in the film, which signify a kind of shift in his character, sort of I do go from being somewhat sympathetic to kind of contemptuous of him, even though he does clearly love his son, but to see the effect that his gambling and cheating and bed hopping has on his wife is also really devastating. So I think in that regard, he becomes less of a hero and more of an anti-hero or even an antagonist.
I think he just becomes pitiable.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say, I mean, it's just pathetic because, you know, he's trying to sort of advance himself in society throughout the film, and then he becomes Barry Lyndon and sort of stagnates because he can't get anywhere else. He doesn't know how to navigate. You know, everything is sort of fine when he's cheating his way to the top, and then when he gets there, there's no way for him to go except to make lateral moves, and he sort of flounders, and so it just becomes a sort of a pitying spectacle.
I don't know what the film's position is on lying and cheating. It's not moralizing, right? Praising him for finding a way to swindle his way to the position that he finds himself in. But is it pitiable that there is a ceiling how far can that really get you? Well, are people in this bourgeois class or they're like their aristocracy? Like how far, there's only so far you can get by those means.
Well, I mean, he gets there by actually being very sort of stubborn and fair and honest in a way and brave in a way, because I feel like he's not the people in the first part of the film. Other people are cheating him, right? Like the rival to his cousin's affection fakes his death. People lie to him to get him out of the village. He gets swindled by a highway robber. I mean, he is the one who's getting conned, right? And he is honest throughout, and until he tries to get out of the army, and he impersonates somebody. But even then, after he gets conscripted into the Prussian army, he does save his commanding officer. So there's kind of he's still sort of forthright in a very sort of naive way. And then when he gets into quote-unquote society, that all the levels of society are characterized by deception or unfaithfulness. So he becomes a police informant, and then he helps that guy cheat at gambling, and then he basically cons his way into a marriage and then cheats on his wife. So all of the strata of bourgeois society is categorized by deception in a way that I don't think the sort of more rural life that he was living before is.
Right.
But I guess you're right that there's not an easy through line for morality, and obviously Kubrick is not here to teach us lessons.
No.
I just feel like there are some measurable differences in the ways in which his sort of more rural life and his more urban life are constructed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about all those candles, shall we? It sounds like this was just a nightmare to shoot, but the effect is breathtaking. I mean, that's part of why this movie is so heralded, or, you know, I think that, yeah, it's gorgeous. In short, every frame looks like a painting, to borrow a Twitter handle. But why was it so important for Kubrick to shoot in this painstaking way, beyond it just looking cool? Michael, do you have thoughts?
Well, I guess because he was a filmmaker of the tradition where there would be a technical or aesthetic angle for all of his films to that point. If you think about 2001 and the optical special effects that were groundbreaking at the time, maybe even Clockwork Orange, while it was a smaller production, shooting in modernist East London to make it look like a futuristic setting. And then here, he saw this as an opportunity to use cutting-edge film technology, technology that actually hadn't been granted to the film industry yet. He was using high-speed lenses that were developed by NASA, I believe, to get these incredibly low-light images, using them to capture film as it had never been seen before, to, as we were talking about earlier, achieve this sense of, he saw it as being an objective, historic document, painstakingly researched, painstakingly lighting all those candles individually and so on, to recreate the past. And looking at it now, 40 years on, it doesn't look real. It looks like a painting, which is mm-hmm. that funny way that when you approach art to recreate reality, often it can be hyper-real and down the line look even more artificial, but incredibly beautiful at that.
Yeah. Mm. But Kristen, what do you think, thematically speaking, what purpose does this style serve?
I mean, I think it helps to serve the narrative of mobility, to have sort of very strongly contrasted pastoral images in the first half of the film, which are connote, you know, landscape paintings and sort of a very rural life with natural light. And then contrast that to the second half of the film, which is almost exclusively indoors and is lit by candlelight or very low natural light. So it's much, much darker. And I think that not only does that change the tenor of the scenes in which they're set, but it also, I think, it changes the behavior and of the characters, to go, especially Barry, to go from outside, and he's more of a rustic personage, kind of a healthy young man, and then to go indoors and to sort of become sick and powdered and crippled, like a lot of those sort of European dignitaries are, with their hideous moles and very kind of sickly looking. And so I think people get maybe a little too distracted with how beautiful the candlelight looks, because I feel like those interior scenes are much more almost jaundiced as compared to a lot of the beginning scenes. And even I would say that he takes that even further, because the first major dueling scene is outside, and even the final dueling scene is inside. There's no reason for mm-hmm. that duel to be inside, and yet they are. And I think that thematically, that is, it's in keeping with the sort of, these people have sort of wrapped themselves up in these structures, but I don't know if it's doing them any good.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I mean, throughout the film, death is outside. Mm. Right, like there are countless deaths. We have all the war scenes are outside, and so these wealthy people have kind of cloistered themselves inside in this like cocoon of expensive right. ornaments and mm-hmm. tapestries.
And I feel like Barry Lyndon's his ruinous amassing of paintings is sort of. Maybe an ironic comment on the beauty of the film itself, in that, you know, he doesn't seem to have a particular particular penchant for any one artistic style. Mm-hmm. He just sees something and wants it. He's not a connoisseur, mm-hmm. I would say. I don't think he knows a good painting from a bad painting.
Yeah.
He just wants whatever is the most rarefied, whatever is the most expensive, mm-hmm. and it does lead to his ruin.
Yeah.
So I think, I mean, the irony is never not thick with Kubrick, and I feel like that's just another layer of sort of almost the cruelty, the cruel hand of the director sort of needling the characters and also the audience, because he is going to make a devastatingly beautiful film, but beauty in some ways is the ruin of Barry Lyndon.
Right. Yeah. I guess we can talk about the critical resurgence of this film.
Well, don't we have to talk about the rejection first?
Sure, yeah.
The contemporary rejection?
Exactly, yeah. When it was first released, this was not considered one of Kubrick's better films. Its box office draw was, it lost a considerable amount of money, which isn't surprising given the production schedule. But
it is surprising that Warner Brothers expected this to be a success.
Right, mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, Warner Brothers in the 70s, talk about they're riding high on their own fumes here. Because, you know, pretty good studio in that decade, but it's laughable to think that this would have made money. My God. I can't imagine. Oh, yeah, three and a half hour blockbuster about 18th century British peerage. Let's do it.
Yeah.
What a moneymaker.
But I think so. Only someone with Kubrick's stature could have made
this
movie. Plus
Ryan O'Neill, very big star.
And Ryan O'Neill, yeah.
At the time.
Yeah. And that's great. I'm glad that he used his star power to for this purpose.
It's true.
Yeah. But it seems critics have since come to their senses.
It's a narrative that I think I'm kind of a little hesitant to kind of paint it that way, mm-hmm. because even though there was like Pauline Kael called it a coffee table movie and there were negative reviews and it didn't light up the box office, it's still, you know, how do we judge how a film is received now? We look at reviews, we look at box office, we look at awards, and in terms of the Oscars, it won 4 Oscars and all for the production, you know, production department, you know, cinematography, production design, makeup and costume, which is, you know, shows that it was by its peers, at least in the Academy, accepted and heralded. And it didn't win Best Picture or Best Director, but you got to, you know, think about it being, you know, 1975, and he was up against, what was he up against, Dog Day Afternoon and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, you know, banner year for cinema.
Right.
And Kubrick did win. And also thinking about Kubrick as this transatlantic figure, none of his films really from the 60s onwards were immediately adored. They were all kind of divisive movies. You know, his next film after this is The Shining, which was notoriously panned in many, you know, and was the very first Golden Raspberries, you know, gave it all sorts of awards. But in the UK, he won Best Director. He beat out Spielberg, Scorsese, and Sidney Lumet for Best Director that year.
Impressive.
At the BAFTAs. So
that's true.
But then it is true that then that sort of stuff does take hold. And over the years, films like that, especially when it's an auteur's body of work, you do then have opportunities for reprisals, revivals, and reassessments.
Mm, right.
And it does seem that this one has had that.
Right, now. Yeah. And this film is often cited as an influence on other directors, and I think maybe that has something to do with why it's been reappraised, mm-hmm. or I mean, if not reappraised, like as you say, it did win many awards, but the reason
I think
that
just
it has
rescued
the legacy,
from the weight of the rest of his filmography,
mm-hmm.
because I think when you look at his filmography, this is certainly an outlier among the types of films that mm-hmm. he was making. I think probably Scorsese has a lot to do with getting people to watch this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting, too, because the discourse around what I think is one of his best movies, The Age of Innocence, which is clearly influenced by Barry Lyndon, is almost the exact same discourse around Barry Lyndon.
Mm-hmm.
It's this thing of, let's adapt this great work of literature with an omniscient narrator, very long runtime, social satire, kind of more gentle than the other films. I mean, you think of Scorsese as a director who has a certain, some of his films have a certain modicum of violence, and that's very alluring. Scorsese obviously has the same thing. Mm-hmm. And it's they're very, very similar films, not only in filmmaking, but the way that they've been received.
I find it interesting when you bring up influence on other directors. Of course, we're talking, you know, the podcast is about the main Sight and Sound list, but they also do the director's list, where they survey, you know, directors the world over. And Barry Lyndon comes higher in that list in 2012. It's 19th out of the 100. And I find it fascinating. I was just looking up who voted for it. And the influence might, again, be different than what you'd expect. The directors that voted for it include Roy Anderson, the Swedish filmmaker, Richard Ayoade, who did The Double and Submarine, Andrew Dominik, the Assassination of Jesse James and the Coward Robert Ford, Mark Romanek, the music video director turned filmmaker, as well as Antonio Campos, who just released Christine in the last year, and Athena Rachel Sangari, who's the sort of Greek New Wave writer and filmmaker. And something that links a lot of those people, especially Roy Anderson, Richard Ayoade, Athena Rachel Sangari, and Antonio Campos, is they are like the droll, darkly comic filmmakers, very formally precise, but you can really see, especially the first half of the film, where it's these, you know, very restrictive, suffocating structures, but with a real line of humor underneath. That seems to be what they've taken or what they're responding to in Barry Lyndon, which I find quite fascinating, really.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think this is the film that speaks to filmmakers just because it's so different from what Kubrick is also doing, and it is less interested in, I think, pleasing or satisfying an audience. It's very much a directorial force, and I think that not only visually, but also in terms of how sort of uninterested it is in maybe traditional narrative filmmaking. It's something that I think speaks to a creative person in a different way, in a different tenor than it does to a regular audience member. Like, this is the Kubrick film for filmmakers.
All right, well, speaking of ranking things, this is the 59th film on the Sight and Sound International Critics Poll. Is it worthy of the 59th spot? Michael, what do you think?
I think it's certainly worthy of being in the 100. I mean, 59 is such a random place in the list, isn't it?
Yeah.
As I said at the top of this, it probably would be my... Let's see, where would I put it in Kubrick? I probably would... I'd put it behind The Shining, certainly. But maybe it would be my second or third choice. So it's the second highest Kubrick in the list. 2001 is higher up.
Yes.
What number is 2001?
It's number six.
Six?
Yep.
Oh my.
And is it only these two Kubricks in the whole list?
No, there's also Dr. Strangelove and A Clockwork Orange.
I mean, I do love Dr. Strangelove. I do think it should be in there, as we say, not just for the formal beauty, but just because it's such a unique film and an odd film in that filmmaker's canon. And nearly all of his other films, maybe his more populist films like Full Metal Jacket, you may go back to that and not necessarily get more from it, whereas Barry Lyndon seems to be a film kind of like Vertigo that over the years different schools of thought are developing around it, and different critics, different generations will reappraise it. I think it should be in there.
That's a good comparison.
Yeah,
I like that Vertigo comparison a lot.
Yeah,
because it is sort of Vertigo is to Hitchcock as Barry Lyndon is to Kubrick, I think.
Yeah.
That's very fair.
Yeah, so maybe in 10 years, this will replace... Because 2001 is the highest rated. We'll see. I'm not making that prediction. That seems crazy. But
yeah, that's a lot of spots to go up.
Yes, it is. But I will say, I think this is my favorite Kubrick film.
Mm.
I said it. Come at me.
I mean, your favorite. You're not really putting anything on the line just to say it's your favorite.
It's true. I know. But how do you... I don't like lots of his other ones.
Mm, yeah.
How's that for a statement? But that's not a nice note to end it on.
That's also very vague.
Yeah. All right.
Make a stand.
I don't like A Clockwork Orange, you're making me. It is.
No, I think the more you watch Clockwork Orange, the less there is.
Okay, fair. There you go.
I mean, and this is the opposite, of, yeah. to me at least.
And would it be in my, if I was asked to submit my top 10 to the list, it wouldn't make my top 10 of all time. So okay. I certainly wouldn't be contributing to its... to it jumping up the list in 5 years' time. Fair. If they do it again. But
do you get to vote?
Well, who knows? The next one is in 5 years. So
okay,
certainly
all right.
5 years ago, I was working there when they were doing it 5 years ago. But who knows? Next time around, where I'll be?
Yes, yes. Well, I think you got an angle for that.
Well, it's a very respected responsibility to have to
yes it is.
And then just yes, you submit your 5 or 10 films, and then you see people judge it like it's some sort of objective 100 list where somebody has said this needs to be 59.
You killed their mother.
Yeah.
I know. I can't believe you killed my mother by putting Barry Lyndon on your list, you monster.
For our next topic, our guest Michael Leder has recently founded a small distribution company in London called Misc Films. It will offer a showcase for some more obscure films that need seeing. I can't speak for all of the listeners out there, but I know I have personally harbored a fantasy that I could one day do something similar. Yeah, I really want to just like open a theater and program my own film thing. That would be really cool. And so, well, we'll talk to Michael about why he started this company and how he plans to lure people out to the theater to see these unfamiliar works. Okay, so Michael, do you want to just give us an overview? What is Misc Films?
Well, okay, what so Misc Films is, I guess, this sort of distribution company programming collective, and well, it's a collective of two. It's me and my colleague Rowan Woods, who is a development editor at BBC Films. And I guess... to set the context, I don't know how it is in LA and across the States, but in London, there's quite a healthy repertory scene. So there are cinemas that are filling out their programs, not just with new releases, but with older films. And within that, there's another healthy kind of sub-community of programming collectives that may have their own unique spin on programming. So there's the Bechdel Test Fest, who are a bunch of female critics who program films that pass the Bechdel test. And there's also a new one called the Final Girls, who are championing films in the horror genre that have interesting representations of women or directed by women. And around this time last year, in fact, I was trying to think of how to get involved. And when I went to the Berlin Film Festival, I saw a film there called Homo Sapiens, which is a documentary by an Austrian filmmaker called Nicholas Gerhalter. And to summarize the film, it's 94 minutes long. No music, no narration, no people. It's a documentary about decaying or deserted spaces around the world. And it's completely, you know, locked off shots, long takes, just living within these spaces that have been abandoned by civilization. And it was incredible when I saw it in Berlin. And as the year drew on, no UK release was announced for it. And I'd sent an email to the production company saying, hey, I love the film. Is there a way to see it in the UK? And they said, nothing planned. So we thought, maybe we could do a screening of this. It's clearly not economically viable, but maybe we could find a way. Because cinemas in the UK, especially in London, have very strong connections with the community and their audience, be it from, you know, through traditional marketing methods or through social media. We have cinemas like the Prince Charles Cinema just off Leicester Square, and small chains like the Curzon and Picture House cinema chains. And they have very diverse programs, and they show interesting films. And I hooked up Homo Sapiens with the Prince Charles Cinema and said, let's show this in a cinema, and they were on board. And we sold a lot of tickets. We almost sold out their big downstairs screen. And off the back of that, I got emails from cinemas, you know, in Belfast, in Manchester, in Bristol, in Nottingham, all across the country, saying they wanted to show the film too. It's helped by the fact that it had the film Homo Sapiens had a 5-star review in The Guardian from Peter Bradshaw, mm-hmm. who is kind of one of the, you know, one of the most prominent critics in the UK. So there was this interest for the film, but no distributor. And I guess I stepped into the shoes of the distributor there.
Okay.
Which is quite exciting. And now it's in March. It's showing, you know, around the UK.
How do you go about getting the rights to these films? Do you just call up IFC, look them up in the phone book, or how does that work?
I mean, that really is it. There's a sort of punk aesthetic. There's a sort of punk aesthetic to this at the moment, where I don't know if it's the same in the States, because you do have some pretty powerful, strong cinemas out there. You know, mm-hmm. Alamo Drafthouse, or you know, there's the Metrograph in New York, and all that. Mm-hmm. But over here, it really is as simple as just calling somebody up and trying to make a deal. Sometimes sales agents or distributors do want quite a lot of money up front, which makes it prohibitive to show some films. But sometimes you can cut a deal with them, and if it's sometimes you can make it work with the cinema. And cinemas over here, the programmers, I mean, I guess maybe we're lucky that programmers are so open to these outside or third-party programmers to collaborate with them. But it really is, in terms of getting started, the two things you need to do is find a film and call up the sales agent or the distributor, and then find the cinema and talk to them about it. And luckily for us, that worked out in both cases.
Interesting. Yeah, there are so many films that are out of print or unavailable that I would love to see get a screening here. I was just talking about in a previous episode about how a lot of films that even best foreign film Oscar contenders, a lot of them are not available in the States, which seems outrageous. And I would really like to figure out a way to get them shown. But it's heartening to hear that it is just as simple as calling up the distributor or calling up whoever owns the rights to the films. Mm-hmm. Do you have any, and I know so far you've started off with these two films, but have you had any trouble figuring out the correct person to contact?
No, that information. Well, yes, there's detective work that goes into it. With, say, Medicine for Melancholy, it was a case of there's no UK representative for the film, and it's an old film, so hard to do. So tracing it back to whoever released it in the States, either theatrically or on DVD. Some of the other films we're looking at, they may be Japanese, they may be from New Zealand, they may be from wherever. It gets much harder. And there is a lot of detective work that goes into it, and especially with films that maybe were small when they were first released, but now have a new relevance. The rights holders may have gone out of business. They might have changed address, changed phone number. So it's a lot of detective work. And that's before you even get to the stage where you want to show it digitally, if you want to show it as a print. Mm-hmm. We're quite lucky because both the films are going to be shown digitally. So the actual transport costs were very minimal. But we have friends who there's a collective called the Badlands Collective who show kind of 1970s, 1980s kind of auteur films, and they only really show from 35mm. Mm-hmm. And for them, it's a much bigger deal because you've got to think about transporting 35mm, prints across the country, across the ocean. That's what makes it tricky. And that's why probably it's harder to do if you're if you want to, say, preserve film and so on.
Right. I mean, would you consider showing a film in 35?
Maybe down the line. 16? I think for what we're doing, it depends on the film. And currently the films we've been looking at have all been shot either digitally or they're the only materials available anyway. But it's certainly in London, from the cinemas we've been talking to and just being part of that community, I go to the cinema so frequently. I'm a regular at all of those places, so I know as an audience member myself what makes a screening notable, and sometimes it is the format that it's being shown from. Mm-hmm. But it's, we'll see whether the right film comes along. And because these are the first couple of screenings we're doing, we probably want to make sure we're not out of pocket straight away.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Yeah. I do not blame you. So
we don't want to be spending money like Barry Lyndon on these, you know, amazing, beautiful paintings, right. Right, filling exactly. our drawing yep. room, so to speak.
Yep. yeah. Just get the images up on the screen, however way possible. What is the, do you have a sense of what the audience is and how big how large the audience will be for these screenings?
Well, it depends on the film. And with Homo Sapiens, the reason why I took this jump with it is because when I saw it myself as a critic, reading the film, I saw the Venn diagram of various approaches to the movie. Sure, you can approach it as an artist's film or a travelogue of abandoned spaces, and it's not by no means a conventional or accessible movie. But then there's also a crossover with, say, I don't know if it's the same, it is online, the interest in urban exploration and what is termed ruin porn online. The idea that people will go out of their way to visit abandoned shopping malls or abandoned islands off the coast of Japan. And there is interest in that. So I saw there would be interest in that regard, as well as the fact that the film had almost felt like a zombie movie without the zombies. These abandoned shots of cathedrals, shopping malls, convenience stores, cinemas, a few theatres as well, sports stadiums. It looked like an establishing shot from Cormac McCarthy's The Road or something. Mm-hmm. So I could see that there would be an interest in that from maybe angles that more... Sure, it could be shown in galleries, but the gallery wouldn't be interested in attracting a crowd that would be interested in those angles. Mm-hmm. But when you're putting on these screenings on a smaller scale, you only really have to think in terms of selling 150, 200 tickets. And that's probably why we can move a bit more flexibly than a larger scale distributor who would be thinking about how to get into 50 screens in terms of the UK, even more if you're in the States, filling out those screens. We're doing... single screenings. We're partnering with cinemas who will have their own marketing channels. They have good newsletters, they have good social media and Twitter, and they know what their audience likes. So they wouldn't book it if they didn't think they had an audience as well. Yeah. So that's what goes into picking the films and thinking about how to show it. It is a little bit more... I mean, when we first started thinking about it, there was an element of, oh, I'd just love to see this on the big screen. But as it goes on, you start to realise, actually, as a critic, as a film viewer, as all the things that you are... you realise that you have been all along thinking about what the angles are of interest for a film like that.
So would you say that your programming then is going to be driven more by audience than by theme or contemporary versus retrospective film? I mean, do you think that your sole motivating factor is how can we get people to see these movies? So you're actively seeking out an audience and then programming from that.
Well, maybe not audience, but certainly this sort of release status. That's what is the immediate impetus for us. And maybe as we go on, there may be themes that become apparent. We've been thinking about, a series of the debut films by French female filmmakers that are now, internationally renowned, but their first films were smaller and maybe
I'd fly up.
Yeah.
Can you get us sold? Can you get us passes?
like who?
Well, let's say in the last year or two, there have been three young French female filmmakers who have had success on an international scale. There's Céline Sciamma, whose film Girlhood came out maybe 2 years ago, but then also she wrote the screenplay for, I think in the States it's called My Life as a Zucchini, the animated film, stop motion film that's nominated for an Oscar. Her first film, Water Lilies, came out in the UK, but had a very limited release, and the distributor... very, I think, haphazardly or prematurely, was an iTunes first distributor, but in 2009. So it was way ahead of the curve and didn't last very long. But then also filmmakers like... who are the others that we're thinking of? There is Katel Killaver, who has a film called Heal the Living that played at Toronto last year. And I'm not sure about its release in the US, but it's an incredible movie. And if it's not nominated for an Oscar this year, I'm sure it's in contention next year. And her first film, or her previous films, are certainly Love Like Poison, very interesting movie, and one that, even if it maybe did get a release at the time, we're interested in pulling it out, dusting it off, and having another look at it. And there are more than that, but then that's how you start thinking. Maybe look at the release calendar for the year. What films are playing at festivals? What films getting buzz? That's how we went for Medicine for Melancholy. We saw Moonlight last year on the festival circuit when it was getting that first wave of buzz, and we thought, who is this guy? And look back. And it's the same, it's interesting that this year there's another film on a similar scale where La La Land, of course, getting all of this Oscar buzz. Very few people know that actually it's his third film. Damien Chazelle's third film. They think it's his second film. They think that Whiplash was his debut, but he made a black and white jazz musical called A Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench, and that didn't get released in the UK. And now there's, people are trying to maybe try and show it, but that's another one that has fallen by the wayside. I think it's on DVD in the US, or maybe it might even be on Netflix or something. I don't know. But
yeah, it was for a while. Yeah.
Right. But in the UK, no one knows about it. In fact, when La La Land played as one of the gala presentations at the London Film Festival, the press notes said it was his, La La Land was Damien Chazelle's second film. And you're thinking, whoa, there's a whole narrative here that we're forgetting because a film wasn't released properly. So that's some of the thinking that goes into it for us. And I know what you mean about always thinking about the audience, and that is true. There is a part of me that wants to show obscure Japanese documentaries or whatever. The filmmaker Hirokazu Koreeda, who I don't know if his stuff gets a proper platform in the States, but Our Little Sister is his most recent film, and After the Storm was at Cannes last year. In the 90s, he made some incredible documentaries for Japanese television, and I studied them at university and wrote about them there. And they've never been shown over here, and I'd love to show them. But that's the sort of that would be the Barry Lyndon, the sort of the lavish box office bomb if we do that down the line.
Maybe build some clout first, and then consider. Then you can indulge yourself.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Well, count Kristen and I in for two tickets for the French film, female film.
Anytime Celine Sciamma is there, I'm there.
All right.
How is the rep scene in LA then? So you have the Draft House. I hear such good things about
Draft House, is it even open in Los Angeles yet? Okay, so the Draft House location in LA, I don't think is open yet. They're building it downtown. Draft House is primarily in Austin, Texas.
Right, okay, sorry.
That's their main one. No, it's okay. I think the rep scene in LA is more geared towards repertory cinema, not necessarily contemporary cinema. Although there is a guy I know who's a critic out here, Jordan Cronk, who founded something similar called Acropolis Cinema. Mm-hmm. And what they do basically is, I think, similar to what you're doing, which is picking up, he goes to festivals all over the year, Locarno, Cannes, things like that, to try to seek out the films that are not going to get U.S. distribution. And they'll screen them at places here, like we have a movie theater here called the Cine Family, which they do a lot of very diverse programming, not only old repertory cinema, but contemporary stuff, independent film, silent, experimental film. So there's a lot on that calendar. And so I've been to a couple of the Acropolis screenings. I saw the documentary Dead Slow Ahead was an example. I think, I saw Camera Person well, which later got a release, but extremely limited. And I was able to see it several months in advance of that. So, I mean, there are sort of those little tiny pockets of screening, screening societies. And then they do the same thing, which is that they pick a venue, whether it's the Vista Theater in Los Feliz, which is a regular first run theater, or whether it's something like Cine Family or, screening series at the New Beverly.
Say the Hammer, the Hammer, one connected to the UCLA Film Archive. Yeah, is one of the best.
But that's coming out of the archival work. That's restorations that have been done by UCLA, by the Academy, by all of these really sterling institutions. But you're right that there are gaps in distributions that I feel like even the LA scene could do a better job of picking that up. Because as much as a movie city it is out here, sometimes you see a film that's getting, you know, lavishly praised at Bernal or Locarno, and it's like, where is this movie? Like, why can't I see it? Mm-hmm. Or you hear about it, and then 2 years later, it gets a release for, you know, two mornings. There's one Saturday screening and one Sunday screening, and they're both at 10 a.m., and if you don't make either of those, you're never going to see it again.
Yeah.
You know, so there is, I think there is a desire to sort of be like, well, why can't these come here? Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. It is the same over here. The, you know, films that we see talked about, you know, in terms of, you know, on American blogs and in American outlets, like The Fitz last year, or The Lure, mm-hmm. which has just come out, I think, over there. I think The Fitz is finally coming out here next month or later in spring. But mm-hmm. The Lure, I don't think, has a UK distributor in place. I think the UK benefits from being so small, you know, in comparison to other markets where, you know, cinemas can club together, and really a big movie only goes out on hundreds of screens as opposed to thousands of screens. So you can put together, we do have relatively small or medium-sized distribution companies. So, for example, there's a brilliant documentary specialist label over here called Dogwoof, and they put out Camera Person. So they, you know, we have... documentary is covered, so we will get those films. I know what you mean, that it is frustrating. I think London's getting there. A lot of my older friends and colleagues talk about the 80s and early 90s as a time where there was like a cinema on every corner in London, and they'd be showing beaten up old prints and late night double bills and triple bills. And when I first moved to London 8-9 years ago, there wasn't really much on the scene. But since then, two or three cinemas have opened that are focusing specifically on rep or archive or, you know, classic cinema. We do have the BFI, which is a tremendous venue. But then also, the, you know, small cinemas like this one called Close Up, which is was funded by Kickstarter. And they just show films off prints, and they, you know, it's likely, you know, they'll have a Bellatar season, and you know, a lot of the artist films, the foreign language films, the sort of stuff people wouldn't deem viable, they show that stuff. So I think we're getting there, and it's interesting just to see the ebb and flow and the development of how to engage those audiences. The Prince Charles Cinema has a good balance between showing these independent or small scale releases, and they do have an audience inbuilt, but then they will do sing along Sound of Music, or they're the London venue that shows the Tommy Wiseau film,
The Room
that, you know, yeah. They've been showing that for years, and he comes over and does the Q&As and the intros, and they sell out every screening of that, mm-hmm. and that probably bankrolls them for the rest of the year.
Yeah, and you have to do all that. Yeah. I think you have to do everything in order to make it viable.
Absolutely. If people want the Sound of Music sing along, give it to them. You know,
And that's the same thing over here too with certain theaters. Like, you know that there are certain movies that will always play a certain theater because that is their audience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But to have 3 weeks of sold out shows of that one movie helps them show the 1928. You know.
The
Lon Chaney movie that 15 people go to. Correct. So it's, you know, you need to have all of that on your calendar.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And but I guess if you're a normal programmer or an independent or an art house programmer, you can learn from that to make all your screenings into an event. Maybe not cheapen or sully the film, but intros, Q&As, and so on do add value and make it. You know, there are such good DVD and Blu-ray labels out there now, and people have such good setups at home. If they want to watch it digitally, they can see it in their living room.
Yeah.
But then, so you've got to react and make it interesting and add value.
You have to make it like a destination.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like that's what the Metrograph has done in New York, which I haven't been to, but they made it into like almost like a clubhouse. You know, they have food, they have drinks, they have a group of people that go there as a place to be. So mm-hmm. it's a destination. And something like Cinefamily in LA has done the same thing, which is it's membership driven. So if you're a member, you get to go to every movie for free.
Brilliant.
which is incredible. And they always have like potlucks and extra things, and I feel like you really have to not only be spot on with the programming, but you actually have to make the space a social space that people want to go to. And then also you have to, I feel like, I don't know how it is in London or the UK in terms of transport, in terms of traffic, in terms of whatever, but in LA it's a huge deal that you have to like make an evening of a program. Mm-hmm. Like if you want people to come out from the burbs, if you want people to drive maybe an hour, pay for parking, whatever, like put some short documentaries or a newsreel or a Q&A or something to mm-hmm. get to make it worth your while to go out. Because as you say, everyone is competing with the allure of staying in and watching Netflix mm-hmm. or watching the Criterion Blu-rays that you have. And so I think you really have to be incredibly proactive with giving people something that they cannot get on their own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so many of those films that you talk about, the festival films that slip through the cracks theatrically, they're showing up on Netflix. So yeah. Two of the films I really enjoyed at festivals last year, one was called Divines or Divine, the French movie, and then the other one was Sandstorm. They both just went straight to Netflix. No theatrical release. And that's the same with 13th, you know, Oscar-nominated documentary, Ava DuVernay, that got very little exposure on the big screen over here. And the reports coming out of Sundance, all my colleagues were going out there just hearing that Amazon and Netflix are hoovering up all these films. Yeah. No one can get a look in. So that means you have to be, I don't know, cinemas will survive. They just need to be proactive and reactive.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I think you have to monitor how they do on those streaming platforms, because mm-hmm. I'm grateful to, in a lot of ways, to Amazon and to Netflix for buying these films to make sure that people see them. But sometimes the properties that they're buying would play better in a communal space. Mm-hmm. And so I mm-hmm. think a lot of the times then it's the job of the rep cinema or whatever to be like, if enough people are talking about this film on Netflix, put it into cinemas. Yeah. Like the Jonathan Demme documentary about Justin Timberlake. Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful music documentary, which is fun to watch by yourself in bed on Netflix, but it would be electric to see it in a movie theater. And I feel like that's something that a programmer needs to consider.
We need to get on this.
Is to maybe be able to recontextualize streaming and sort of bring it back mm-hmm. to this communal experience that we all, you know, enjoy.
Mm-hmm. All right. I like that. Let's end it there. I feel like this episode has been pretty upbeat on the whole. But just for good measure, let's make sure we close things out on a positive note. Kristen, what's one movie, TV show, song, poem, Carrie Brownstein photo that you've been digging lately?
I'm sorry.
I did that to you.
Excuse me to the listeners. Well, now I'm just thinking about Carrie Brownstein photos and I can't concentrate.
Sorry.
So we've really...
I messed you up.
You've really ruined it. Gosh, I have a couple.
Okay.
I'm reading this collection of poetry called Rome by Dorothea Lasky, who I had never heard of, but she's a contemporary poet. And it's good as heck. I'm really enjoying it. I feel like I constantly need to read poetry now just to get me through the day. Like I feel so inundated by news and despair, and it's insane. So just like reading a poem is nice.
Yeah.
I'm like also that. Like finding a lot of solace in protests and just community and getting out into the street and being around people who are there to exercise their rights, but also exorcise the frustrations or the anxieties or whatever that they have internally, and to just kind of put that energy out into a public space, I'm finding is very restorative and incredibly strengthening. So hope to see you out there, guys.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Michael, how about you?
Well, I'll go for two as well, although they seem so lightweight compared to protesting and poetry, I must admit. First of all, yesterday I finally saw the festival favourite and Oscar-nominated German 2.5-hour-long comedy, Tony Erdmann.
Which
I... All the reviews over here were saying how much of a laugh riot it was, and I was so surprised at how kind of melancholy and sad it was as well. It's almost quite an apt film to have for an episode where we've been talking about Barry Lyndon, because it's a very long film where you can luxuriate in the aesthetic of the movie, but also, unlike Barry Lyndon, it is so interested in characters and character relationships, and in terms of this dysfunctional father-daughter relationship. And while as with all the trailers and clips have suggested, this father bothering his daughter by turning up at her workplace in a variety of costumes, it is funny, but there is something really quite sad but human and true about how we relate to our family members, how we lie to our family members and to ourselves, and how, you know, the wrong relationship at the, you know, can make a difference at the right time. That is heavy and big. And my second thing that's making me happy, that's positive at the moment, is Pure Escapism. And we've been talking about Netflix, and I'm a little bit, it's a bit of a guilty pleasure, although I hate that term, Riverdale has just started. And it's come out of nowhere. This is the Archie Comics TV series where they've sort of infused Archie with Twin Peaks, where there's a murder in small town Riverdale, and the Archie characters that you may know and love have all been given a bit of a makeover. And it's just phenomenal. It completely gives into all teen drama, teen supernatural drama, or whatever conventions and cliches. But I'm a bit of a comics fan and a comics reader, and I've grown weary of the Marvel, DC, big blockbuster movies and the sort of fan service synapse fire that they seem so intent on hitting every time with those movies doesn't work on me anymore. And it was so exciting to watch the first episode in particular of Riverdale and the second episode as well, and just seeing what they were doing with the characters and recognizing what they've been doing, like, oh, there's a band with girls in. Yeah, it's Josie and the Pussycats, and so on. It's been such a fun thing to watch. It's only two episodes up on Netflix right now, and hopefully it'll keep my interest. But that has made me very happy this week.
I like that.
Have you seen Riverdale, you two?
I saw the pilot.
Yeah.
I like that they got the Betty and Veronica kiss out of the way, because they, you know...
Wow,
we're waiting for it. I thought that was going to be the mid-season finale, but nope, right away.
Yeah, and Luke Perry as Archie's hot dad.
Yes,
know, it's
good.
All sorts.
What? Wow.
And I'd love that. I hope that eventually they'll bring in Sabrina Spellman, you know, and go full Archie later on. But the second episode brings in Sugar as well, like a crazy
perfect
pop remix of it. And if you even have a passing familiarity with those characters in that world, there's something for you there.
Oh my god, Jughead's so emo.
He's so emo.
Jughead
played like Joseph Gordon-Levitt in Brick. Yeah. I'm there,
yes,
for that.
Yeah. We shall see. I love it. So I just really quickly, like Kristen, I've been looking for ways. I'm looking for solace, and comfort in these dark times. And I've found that there's a New York Times podcast called Still Processing that's been helping me navigate a lot of my emotions surrounding recent current events. It's co-hosted by Wesley Morris and Jenna Wortham, who are two columnists, I think. Mm-hmm. For the New York Times, and I hardly feel like the New York Times needs my plug, but it's genuinely been a comfort in helping to like process some of all of my feelings about last year's election, And plus, in addition to that, there's lots of talk about current events, as well as like pop culture and movies and music. And by music, I mean primarily Rihanna and Kanye stuff. But there's, you know, occasionally they'll venture into other things too. But yeah, they're delightful, and I love it. Oh yes, and Kristen is pointing out, you must remember this is back.
Yes.
Oh, new season. Yes. Dead Blondes.
Thank you. Very excited. Thank you, Karina. Yes. I know you're listening. Hi.
Come on the show. Do you think we can get her?
Oh my God. If you got Karina Longworth, first of all, I would like, I wouldn't even be here to be on the show. I would just be here to like sit on the couch and listen.
Okay.
Because I love her.
I would allow that. But I think she's actually in London now. So
you are more likely to
Or
she moved back. She was here for a while because, you know, Rian Johnson was making the Star Wars movie. Right. So they were both over here.
Someone track her down.
Yeah.
I think we tried to get her for some further screening at Somerset House to do an intro for Sunset Boulevard, which would have been brilliant. But
could we bribe her with Dodgers tickets? Can we get Dodgers tickets? Come to West LA, Karina.
I love that podcast. I'm so glad it's back.
Fantastic. Just listening to the first episode, and I was driving to UCLA, and I was driving by the Getty, and it was foggy and dark and cold, and she's talking about Peg Entwistle jumping off of the Hollywood sign, and I was just like, I love Los Angeles. I love Los Angeles. It's so dark and romantic, and this series is going to be so good for driving alone late at night. It's just going to be like the most romantic, like Mulholland Drive-y like stuff. I'm so psyched. Mm-hmm. I'm so psyched.
Mm-hmm.
So LA is nothing like La La Land. So
no.
It's more like Mulholland Drive, Lost Highway than
absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
As a true Angeleno, I refuse to see La La Land.
I just saw it, and it bears virtually no resemblance to the actual Los Angeles.
I live a mile from the Colorado Bridge in Pasadena, aka the Suicide Bridge. Mm. So anytime, unless Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone throw themselves off of that bridge in the movie, that is not an accurate depiction of Los Angeles, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. No, I think for a really good portrayal of Los Angeles, I think Lynch is actually a very good place to turn.
Mm-hmm.
I think
he's a Midwesterner, and he understands how bizarre Los Angeles is, but he also loves it.
Yes. And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, what do you think of Barry Lyndon? Come let us know on our website, flickswise.com. And you can come share your thoughts on our Facebook page, facebook.com/flickswise. Then afterwards, you should follow me on Twitter. The handle is @flickswise. But before you do all of that, you must follow my orders and head over to iTunes. There you must rate us and leave us a nice comment. If you refuse, we'll turn you over to the Prussians. On our next show, we have more delights from the Isle of Britain. This time, listener Jessica Gilbert will offer the submission of Monty Python and the Holy Grail for the FlixWise favorites list. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, Michael, thank you so much for joining us on this transatlantic exchange.
No, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And where can people find you on the internet?
Well, on Twitter, I'm Michael J. Leader. And MISC Films is MISC, MISC, _films on Twitter.
Okay. Sales?
My handle on Twitter is Sales on Film. And that's where you can find me.
All right.
Tweeting about, I don't even know what I'm tweeting about today. Kristen Stewart, I think I'm tweeting
probably,
about today.
Yeah.
So whenever you listen to this, I'll probably still be tweeting about her.
All right, listeners, I hope you've had your satisfaction.